Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast that puts the bail in bailout. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey, Corey.
So, listeners, at the time of recording, we are 26 days away from October the 31st and the Halloween Armageddon no deal Brexit. I think I'm going to spend October the 31st watching Shaun of the Dead at the Electric, which is probably... It feels an appropriate way of spending.
Is that your no-deal strategy? Just grab the cricket bat and then head down to the Winchester's Arms and until it all rolls over?
There'll definitely be, yeah, beer and waiting, I think, obviously in our nuclear bunker. We have already talked about Labour Party conference. We talked about Lib Dem conference and we are doing a midweek shop on the Tory Party conference this week. Boris Johnson has an interesting political strategy to try and get Brexit done and win a general election. Will it work? Boris Johnson put forward a Brexit deal this week, which he unveiled not to Parliament, obviously, because that might involve some sort of scrutiny. It was first unveiled at Tory Party conference. It was presented as a take-it-or-leave-it approach to the EU, because, as we've seen, Steve, if you hector and bully the EU enough, they will eventually give you what they want. That's what the Brexit negotiations have proved.
Oh, time and time again, absolutely.
It had an interesting way of dealing with the issue of the Irish border and the Irish backstop. The backstop, as you will remember, is to keep a border open in Ireland because that honours the Good Friday Agreement, because that's an international treaty and that's a good thing.
Yep. And the government's attempt to get around the backstop was to make it not a backstop anymore. Again, kind of reverting back to the time-honoured tradition at this point of saying it's a time-limited backstop, thus making it not a backstop at all.
We have a safety net, Steve, but it only works for a few months or a few years. And after that, it ceases to be a safety net. That doesn't really work.
No, it doesn't work at all. I mean, the entirety of the government's Brexit proposals here are somewhat fanciful. I mean, we've had that confirmed actually about 10 minutes or so ago when just before we started recording, we discovered that essentially the EU have just turned around and said, no, there's no point in Boris Johnson coming over before the EU summit because the things he's put forward are not the basis of any meaningful proposal at all.
And essentially, the reason why these proposals are seen as a non-starter by the EU is because they do involve checks on the Irish border, except the plan was for checks not to happen at the border itself, but at various customs posts.
Yeah.
Either, I think, about 5-10 miles either side of the border.
Yeah, so specifically, this is actually seems to have been something that the government has been kind of working towards for a while, because there were some old PSNI police stations in Northern Ireland which were up for sale, or well, at least the land they were on was up for sale. Those sales were halted, and it looked like that these were probably going to be a part of the government's Brexit solution to the Northern Irish border problem. And lo and behold, what they've suggested is essentially within a set radius, effectively, of the border on both sides, you will have custom checkpoints where people can go and just quickly get kind of hand-waved through. They will. What they'd look to do is utilise the trusted trader scheme that the EU utilises for some certain countries and certain businesses within certain countries. I think this is primarily used in places like Switzerland. Right, essentially, as a company, you register, you go through some rigmarole and some testing, and they say, yes, we trust you. You don't necessarily have to go through, be checked as often or whatever.
I find it fascinating that the whole point of Brexit, apparently, was to get rid of the EU's red tape. And the government's proposal seems to involve a situation where businesses have so much more red tape and paperwork to fill out than they will do originally.
Absolutely, and it's not just in this limited instance of the Northern Irish border. One of the areas which has, you know, understandably not necessarily received the same level of news coverage as other areas is around actually data. Data obviously is something which flows very freely currently between pretty much every single European country or member of the EU. When we leave the EU without a deal, then actually businesses are left in a very tricky situation where they're not necessarily going to be able to have access to the data of their own customers if that company is based in the UK but they've got European branches or European customers, because they're not going to have a trusted status within EU regulation. Because the way it works currently is by being a member of the EU, we have to abide by certain laws and regulations on basically keeping people's data safe, GDPR, that kind of thing. Once we leave, we lose that trusted status, and then we would need to go into bureaucracy, either on the level of each individual business having to go through some bureaucracy or the government as a whole having to go through some bureaucracy to actually maintain or regain that trusted status that we have. Pretty much throughout every single kind of layer of Brexit, there is an extra layer of bureaucracy that we are going to have to deal with in some form.
And the checks on the Irish border, and again, I'm indebted to an article on politics.co.uk which kind of sets it out in a bit more depth. But essentially, with border checks, again, there is a trade-off. If you're going to have checks, you either have to have lots of posts all across the border, in which case that's quite expensive, or you're going to have a few points where you check and they are going to become very, very busy and possibly become overwhelmed very, very quickly. And you also then have the added trouble, when you think about the troubles in Northern Ireland and the history of that region, that any border post is going to be the target of attacks, essentially. Yeah. You can see people trying to drive through those through those checks, and then you've got to put army out and soldiers out to defend and protect against that situation. And
suddenly you've militarised the border again. Now, the reality is the IRA are more likely to be caught smuggling drugs through the border than actually attacking it directly these days. But the point is still pretty sound. And there is definitely a symbolic level of meaning to like the notion that we may end up remilitarising this border.
You can see that it could be a smuggler's paradise, just in terms of just avoiding the tariffs that come in. So we've been reading the UK and the Changing Europe report on No Deal for both this episode and for try and go into No Deal in more detail on a future podcast. I believe I'm right in saying that a normal lorry load of beef going across the Irish border will be subject to, I think, £70,000 worth of tariffs. And those with cheese and dairy, it will be subject to £52,000 worth of tariffs. So that's a hell of a lot of extra costs can be imposed on businesses, especially considering those businesses are also going to have to put in the extra paperwork you were talking about, which is obviously then disproportionately affecting smaller businesses who can't cope with this sort of stuff.
And then you have the wonderful situation where effectively with trusted trader schemes and things like that, those tend to be given to bigger businesses just because they tend to have the more the volume of movement. So to make it seriously worthwhile for them. But then equally, what we're then basically saying is, do we trust businesses and corporations to not play around with the rules and not try and abuse the situation? The reality is, even in highly regulated areas like, say, the auto industry, we have modern examples of Vauxhall having to recall thousands of cars.
Yes, I was thinking the Volkswagen as well, which the politics.co.uk mentions about the emissions and fixing that. So, yes, it's as we've talked about on the podcast before, in fact, very recently with football clubs, self-regulation does not work. Boris Johnson's aim, it seems to be, was to have some very intensive discussions over the weekend before the EU summit. As Steve said, 10 minutes before we started recording, the EU kiboshed that option. it feels like, again, the British government is hoping, well, if we go round to Merkel and Macron and do some nice shuttle diplomacy, then things will work out, forgetting that's not how the EU works. No. And that's what Michel Barnier is there for. For the love of God. As Nick Robinson put it on Twitter this week, Theresa May got a deal together which the EU signed off on but MPs wouldn't. Boris Johnson's got a deal that MPs might sign off on but the EU won't. There have been some noises that the DUP backed this plan, even though, again, I think I'm right in saying that the Northern Ireland would align with the Republican Ireland on goods, so you'd also have a regulatory border on the Irish Sea, which I thought was one of the DUP's red lines, which seems to have kind of been brushed aside. But the DUP's on board, the ERG have made interesting noises suggesting they might back a bill. Some Labour MPs have as well. I know Gareth Snell and Ruth Smith, both Stoke MPs, heavily leave seats. They've talked about trying to back the government on this one. But it looks like a non-starter. We're in a Brady Amendment situation with the House of Commons. Yes, they might vote for this, but there's no way the EU can countenance it. Yep. And judging by reports in the Irish media, obviously people like Tony Connolly from RTE have been very, very good in the Irish border situation. Their view was that the plan that Johnson's put out is basically the Irish government's no-deal plan in terms of making sure that we have border checks on the EU's external border in the event of a no-deal Brexit. So it's hard to see how this can be a viable long-term deal.
No.
And then you have the situation of, well, if Johnson can't get this plan through, is he going to obey the law and write a letter extending EU membership?
Well, there was an interesting little tidbit which occurred at some point during the week. Part of a submission to like the Scottish High Courts,
yep.
The government submitted a piece of paperwork that said, we have every intention of obeying the law, we will send this letter. Which is obviously massively different to the rhetoric that's coming out of the government, and specifically in like just going back to Boris Johnson's speech at a Conservative Party conference, what he was saying in there as well. It's all very well good kind of blustering and trying to claim that he'd rather die in a ditch before extending the deal, but then they probably are still desperately trying to find a way out of it, but I think they know that they have to.
You listeners must be as shocked as we are to find that Boris Johnson is saying one thing to one group of people and another thing to a different group of people. I can't believe he's not a straight-talking politician we assumed he was. I think it's also the government can't say in a submission to the court that they are going to break the law. Because I'm guessing, again, I'm no lawyer, but I don't imagine judges would find favour with that situation.
No, one can't imagine they'd be very happy about that.
I think, and we talked about this last week, didn't we? They will probably try and find a way around it. Or I imagine, again, a lot of what is happening with Johnson and his Brexit deal at the moment is it is for public consumption.
Yep.
And it's about trying to shift the blame game, I think. So I think there's a two-faceted process, isn't it? I think one of them is, if no deal does happen, then it's shifting the blame to the EU for that.
Yep.
Which I think will be difficult because, again, assumptions are difficult to make at this point. I think the EU are going to try and make sure they're not blamed for a no deal and they'll be happy to extend and block no deal, if only just so they don't completely... so that they have solidarity with the Republic of Ireland and their government, I think. The other way in the politics of Johnson's Brexit deal is if he's forced to sign an extension, essentially that's the cover that Johnson and Cummings have to try and lead a people versus parliament election, and Johnson can say, well, I was forced to do this by the Remain saboteurs in parliament and the people and the surrender bill and the people in the... Oh, we shouldn't call it the surrender bill, we should reframe it, we should call it the economic Armageddon prevention bill and the judges in the House of Lords. And I think that could wash, actually, if Johnson goes into an election either before the end of this year or early next year. I can see an argument where he's saying, well, I want to do this, but I was thwarted by Parliament. Give me a mandate to do that. It's not a daft strategy. It's terrible for the country, but it's not daft.
No, the only issue he's got, though, is the Brexit Party. Because essentially Nigel Farage in the past has already said if the Tories don't get this done, then we're going to war. Now, Farage has kind of rolled back that a little bit since then.
Maybe light skirmishing rather than war.
Light skirmishing. And has in fact proposed an alliance and wanting to work together with the Tories, which Boris Johnson has swiftly poo-pooed and said, no, we're not going to work with them. So you're then left in a situation where the Tories have scorned the Brexit Party leadership and said, no, we're not going to go anywhere near these people. We don't want to work with them. And they failed to deliver on Brexit, which sets Nigel Farage up quite nicely to be able to go, the Tories can't be trusted on this. They're not capable of delivering. Like, vote for the Brexit Party, which can easily undermine the entirety of Johnson's narrative. Weirdly enough, I say weirdly, but in some ways, not that surprising, I strongly suspect the entirety of that next general election, whenever it is, could easily hang on just whatever the hell Nigel Farage decides to do.
And then tactical voting by voters as well. We talked a lot in our last midweek shot about people voting tactically in pro-Remain voters in Labour Conservative marginals.
Yeah.
And equally, Tory Party, Brexit Party voters have the same dilemma, I suppose. Maybe a flip side to that is that generally, those who are voting for the Brexit Party, they tend to be voters who generally aren't voting tactically, but maybe voting more as a protest and might not vote Tory in any sense. The situation at the moment in terms of the polls would look very different if Johnson were to seek a Brexit extension. The only problem with that, and it's a massive, massive problem, is the caveat with hypothetical polling.
Yeah.
So we had Tory Party Conference, which started with mugs saying that they were going to get Brexit done, which don't have the date of October the 31st on. Obviously, we've talked about how Boris Johnson takes a lot of inspiration from Theresa May, but I feel like putting a policy on a mug and having that as a hostage to fortune is very peak Ed Miliband. I'm waiting for the Boris Stone in which they have this, you know,
the day of October 31st carved literally into stone.
Yes. In fact, I imagine Marc Francois is probably ordering one right now. So that was fun. Obviously, the fact that the Tories were trying to position themselves as the party of law and order, having literally spent the last week talking about how the House of Lords weren't impartial and the government wasn't able to do things legally. And also, Godfrey Clifton Brown, one of their MPs, had to be escorted from the conference by security because he tried to get into a fringe event with his fiancée who didn't have a pass, and security wouldn't let her in without a pass. And I lost his temper so badly that he had to be escorted from the conference. Makes Labour Party conference look like a hive of wonderfulness and unity.
Yeah.
We had a lot of Brexit nonsense at Tory Party conference, like Johnson in his speech, which was basically an extended Daily Telegraph column in which he used all the same jokes that he was using 5 years ago, just not in a kind of entertaining way, in the way that we reuse our old jokes. And there were some policies announced. Esther McVey, new housing minister, said that architects were going to start designing houses in 3D, which is very useful because the nuclear bunker at the moment, Steve, is 2D. And honestly,
I guess we could do it with an entire new dimension.
Not having the dimension of height.
Yeah.
Is problematic in a house. So, and it will help the other Tory policy, which is people will be able to build two extra stories on their house without planning permission. And if you don't have that third dimension of height, it's very difficult to build extra stories on your house.
Esther McVey's policy announcement was essentially that now you can add a second story to your home without planning permission. As though this is somehow a revolutionary thing which is going to massively make a difference to people's lives.
Does the plan have flaws, Steve?
The plan does have flaws. Primarily just the fact that it's not actually going to impact anyone really at all. Effectively, the cost, excluding that, of a loan to be able to build that second floor is £53,000. That's excluding VAT. So 20% on top of that?
To put it into context, that's the equivalent of tariffs that you're going to have to
Pay on. Well, yeah.
Maybe you could do, when we lose currency, there was some barter situation where there'll be a loaf full of cheese in exchange for an extension.
But yeah, so 53 grand excluding VAT. And again, I looked up the loan that it would cost to do that. Anywhere between £300 and £500 a month to pay that loan back within like the standard kind of time frames.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not unaffordable for some people. Like, it is something that could be done, but you're looking only at like kind of like people who are very well off. Families aren't going to be able to afford that. You need to be earning a significant amount of money to be in a position where you can afford an extra £300 to £500 a month on top of your existing mortgage, on top of your bills, on top of everything else. It's just an absolute insanity.
We've talked a lot in the past about Tory policies like universal credit or photo ID to vote. Often come from an aspect of the Tory party not really understanding the lives of a lot of ordinary people and assuming that everyone has a nice middle class existence with lots of savings and photo ID, all that kind of stuff. And this is, as you say, like assuming that, oh yes, I know how we're going to win all those voters who are voting for Labour and the Liberal Democrats. They obviously have 53 grand ready to spaff up the wall, literally spaff up the wall, yeah, on an extension. You think about how the Tory party could win a lot of voters back. There was a lot of red meat, so Priti Patel speech, a lot of old-fashioned red meat about, yeah, you know, we're going to stop free movement, we're going to give criminals longer sentences, all that kind of stuff. What part of the reason I think the Tory party has a problem in the long term is that the reasons why people become conservative when they get older are not necessarily happening. So housing is a very good example. You know, usually the reason why people maybe stop voting for a left-wing party and vote for more kind of conservative parties tends to be, well, you have a family, you have a house, you have things to conserve, you have things to protect. Well,
you've had a career where you've progressively started earning more and more money, and therefore you get to a point where actually those tax increases aren't going to affect you.
And you have a stable permanent job is the thing. Whereas if you've got a situation where a lot of people do not have a stable job on very insecure contracts, or lots of piecemeal 0 hours contracts and things like that. You've got a situation where the housing market's completely screwed and people don't have a place of their own, where often people are putting off having children because they haven't got either the money or the housing in which they want to bring their kids up in. Well, obviously, that's why we saw quite a big swing to Labour among voters in their 30s and 40s in 2017. And the Tory party response has not really been to say, oh, well, let's build houses and let's try and address these issues. Yes, it's trying to do it in terms of austerity, but I just think about, you know, Margaret Thatcher and her Right to Buy, which created the new generation of Tory voters. If the Tories built new towns or renovated lots of houses and voters bought them, they would be a generation of voters that would probably vote Conservative on that basis.
The Tories have just I don't know, they seem to have completely missed the target into what made people vote Conservative. They seem to have just got it into their head that they can just continue to reach out to people who are already voting Conservative. So unless this policy is designed as some red meat to try and bring the Brexit Party back on board, but then again, the Brexit Party, I don't necessarily think, one, is going to care about this policy, and two, even if they do, I'm not sure the bulk of their membership or voters are even going to be the sorts of people that could benefit from it.
Well, I think you made a good point on the show last week where...
That's a rarity.
I know. Well, I wasn't going to make the joke, but you made it for me, but about how essentially a lot of the Tory party has become a kind of Leninist party.
Yeah.
A very populist, bring down the establishment, get Brexit through, get Brexit done, despite the fact that no deal would lead to another 40 years of uncertainty. But I think their feeling is, well, we're going to lose seats in Scotland.
Yeah.
We're going to lose seats to the Lib Dems. So we need to take seats off Labour. We are in a good position to take seats off Labour because they have an unpopular leader and unpopular Brexit policy.
Mm-hmm.
So I think they kind of have this stereotype of the working class Brexit voter in the North, which, as we've said, is a little bit of a misnomer because working class wasn't a determinant of whether you voted Leave or Remain, but middle class was. Yeah. But I think they assume that issues like tougher sentences, say, allow them to differentiate from Jeremy Corbyn, who they're going to try and portray as soft on crime,
yeah,
say. And it's a bit of a wage issue. Despite the fact, actually, Corbyn did quite well in the last election by highlighting police cuts.
Even though that, you know, crime and punishment are things that do normally resonate quite nicely for the Conservatives, unless they're going to turn around and say, actually, here's all of the extra police that we're going to put on the streets to make people safer, Labour can just turn around and say, you've cut the number of police force. We pointed this out 2 or 3 years ago and you still haven't done anything about it.
Johnson's administration wants to try and show distance from the May administration. So there is a magical money tree.
Yeah.
And they want to bring back, spend more money on police officers and build 40 new hospitals, which turns out only really to be six.
Yeah, only six, and the other 40 are planned at some point.
The money will come in the future, says Matt Hancock. Can you imagine? Imagine if John McDonnell had said the money would come from the future. I just imagine the front pages, but, yeah. You know, structural bias of the media. You look at, say, things like collapse of Thomas Cook, which happened a week or two ago. The government refused to bail out Thomas Cook because it said that there was a moral hazard in bailing out companies. And I think actually, if they were trying to show it was a different form of Tory government, then you would actually try and help Thomas Cook out and help that industry out. And actually, I think what Labour's line will try and be in 2017, what Labour's line I think will be in the upcoming election is, this is the same old Tory party, you can't trust them. Mainly because that's basically Labour's line every election.
Yeah.
But the things that really hit through in 2017 were things like fox hunting,
yeah.
Which showed that actually may seem to be a different kind of conservative, but essentially they're not really interested in working people. And I think they'll try and do things like that. And I think actually Thomas Cook's a good example of actually it's still a very much a neoliberal free market government.
I know exactly how Labour will play it. They'll play all of those video clips of Boris Johnson saying, "I was one of the few people that defended the bankers during during the crash." Compare and contrast that to Thomas Cook and to the, you know, the various other policies which are having negative effects on ordinary working people, and say this is a man who's more interested in helping his mates than helping you.
Okay, fair enough. So will Johnson's domestic policy work? Will it actually win an election? I mean, in terms of the polls at the moment, Tories are actually, for all that we've talked about the weakness of the Johnson regime, how his premiership just feels in a bit of a constant state of chaos, the Tories are 10 points-ish ahead in the polls. The Tories are about 32-35% of the vote. But Lib Dems and Labour anywhere between about 20 and 24, depending on the poll. It looks like the Lib Dems had a bit of a bounce from their conference. I've not seen evidence of Labour having a bounce from their conference yet, but I'm sure it's early days.
No, and there's some other interesting little tidbits around basically the Brexit positioning of Labour and the Lib Dems, where the Lib Dems are now are being identified by voters of all types as being an anti-Brexit party, and no one knows, and Labour isn't. So there's all kinds of fun and games there potentially for Labour moving into a general election.
Well, those figures were very interesting because I remember, I'm pretty sure we would have talked about it on the podcast at the time, and we probably had. If we did, we probably had a little bit of a giggle at the Lib Dems. Sorry, Mark. Because I think a similar proportion of people thought Labour and the Lib Dems were an anti-Brexit party. It was about 40-odd percent for both. Whereas, as you say, I think Labour it stayed about 43% of people see Labour as an anti-Brexit party, and that stayed the same over the past...
But for the Lib Dems, their messaging seems to have actually started to cut through now with enough focus, it becoming more of an issue, multiple potential reasons for that, and so that potentially could be very beneficial for the Lib Dems and negative for Labour. Let's be honest, if that does happen, then I think we can almost identify Labour conference as the point that has started happening.
It's hard to say how that plays out in the national election because, as we keep saying,
tactical voting.
Yep. So ignore any national projections based on poll numbers. Just don't bother looking at electoral calculus. It's not gonna help.
It won't help at all.
The other thing then, in terms of will Boris Johnson's strategy work, is the anti-parliamentary forces arranged around him. Can they get a vote of no confidence together? And again, Patrick Cook asked a question about this on the podcast last week, and it didn't look like there was going to be much of a chance of a no confidence vote. Or I said there wouldn't be one. Until we had the completed summit, probably October the 19th, when the deadline comes for Johnson to send that letter asking for an extension. There was no vote of no confidence this week, and the Lib Dems are still refusing to back Jeremy Corbyn as a caretaker prime minister. And so you've just got...
stalemate.
Where Labour's refusing to countenance any other option. And again, you can see why. And the Lib Dems don't want to put Jeremy Corbyn in number 10. Which again... we can see why from their point of view.
Yeah, from the party political perspective, it makes absolute sense for them. The issue, though, then boils down to at what point do you put the national interest above your own political interest. And I would also say that also holds true for Labour, mm-hmm. and Jeremy Corbyn in particular. Yes, I can totally see why you want Corbyn as the caretaker PM, but equally, national interest trumps the party political interest in that area as well.
What I don't know is how it affects relations between Swinson and Corbyn personally, because I know that other part that members of all the other opposition parties have been meeting in Corbyn's office, including Swinson, yep. to plan out what they're going to do. And so it's hard to know how much of this is just activists on Twitter being trolls.
Yeah. Or arseholes.
Yeah. And how much of it actually is easy actually for the leaders' offices in both parties to shrug it off and say, it's fine, because we're still going to work day to day to sort this out.
Yeah, and as and when something comes up, you know, we will find a solution.
And that's the extent to which we don't know that. Yeah. I think it was pretty clear in 2010 that Nick Clegg didn't really want to work with Gordon Brown, and also didn't even want to work with Ed Balls either.
Yeah.
It's not quite clear if there's that personal antipathy with Swinson and Corbyn. I suspect we won't know until the memoirs and the diaries come out.
Pretty much.
We'll have another podcast out on Sunday and probably another midweek shot out as well next week. In the meantime, our website's notenoughchampagne.com. You can follow us on Twitter at nochampagnepod, or on Facebook, it's facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. James Cram designed our logo. You can follow him on Twitter at James Cram. And Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Good Times. I'm at Paperback Rioter.
I'm at Acoustic Radical.
Happy plotting.